Thank you. So I wanted to thank the organizers for asking me to talk today. So we're going to go ahead and go back to thinking about the SU2 Hubbard model. So this is work I did in collaboration with Dimitri Abanin and Shivaji Sandi, both at Princeton. So we've heard a lot about this, but I'm just going to give kind of one slide on general context. So the half-filled Hubbard model and the honeycomb lattice, Thomas, Stefan, Assad, and others have done this exact determinant quantum Monte Carlo calculation. And what they find is they find good evidence for a spin liquid between ut of 4.3 and 3.5. And so our main goal today is sort of to understand to some extent what's going on here. So how does they identify the spin liquid? Well, they look at a whole series of correlators, thousands of correlators, and they identify sort of the absence of order in all these correlators. So what do we mean when we say it's numerically exact? We mean that they have a method, and that their method gives correlators to arbitrary accuracy. And this is useful, especially to identify ordered phases, but to try to understand the properties of spin liquid phases, this is non-trivial, mainly because there is no order in these things. So we're going to go ahead and we're going to use sort of a different approach today to try to understand things. We're going to go back and we're going to try to write down good variational ansatz, good guesses for the wave functions of things that represent this spin liquid phase. So that's going to be the overall goal for the day. Now this is a little bit of a funny thing to do because variational Monte Carlo obviously is systematically biased. It's only as good as your guess. And here they have an exact method. But the upside of this is at the end of the day, we're going to have some explicit wave function, the wave function that we think is a good guess for this spin liquid phase. And this explicit wave function that we have is going to allow us to sort of have a lot more information about what the spin liquid phase is that one may not be able to get to by just looking at correlators. So that's the overall game plan. So our first step, actually, is we're going to go ahead and we're going to write down an effective spin model. So we're going to take the Hubbard model, do some perturbation theory, and write down an effective spin model. Today, we'll be primarily concerned about a J1, J2 model. So J1 is the nearest neighbor on the honeycomb. J2 is the second nearest neighbor on the honeycomb. One can work out in perturbation theory what the U over T's correspond to which J2 over J1's to some order, six order or whatever. And this is the correspondence here. So the spin liquid they find between U over T of 4.3 and 3.5. And the J2 over J1s that correspond to this go between 0.08 and 0.12. So presumably, this is sort of a reasonable spot to be looking at the J2, J1 model for the properties of the spin liquid thing. Now, what is it we've ignored when we've done this? Obviously, we know at large U, we get back just a J1. And as we turn it down, more and more terms show up. Sort of at the next order, we've ignored J3. Presumably, J3 doesn't make a huge difference. This is a bipartite lattice. J3 is non-frustrating. Presumably, J3 largely renormalizes this J1. Maybe it stabilizes some phases a little bit, moves around phase boundaries somewhat, but doesn't make a huge difference. We've also ignored ring exchange in this study, which also comes in at the next order. So it's coming in at t to the 6 over u to the 5. So that's on the order of 1 over 1,000. So we're going to go ahead and we're going to ignore it, at least for this work. Yeah, so that's a great question. It's not clear what the prefactor on this ring exchange is. It's possible that it's large, in which case we should go back and more carefully actually look at the addition of this ring exchange term. So one should really try to figure out exactly what that prefactor is. But I don't know for sure what it is. OK, so today we'll focus on J1 and J2. OK, so there's been a lot of work on both the Hubbard model and the effective J1, J2 model. I should point out that once you've turned this to a spin model, once you've turned on J1 and J2, there is no longer a numerically exact method to solve it. This now becomes something that one can't do without a sign problem and one has to do with other methods. And so a lot of people have looked at these things with different methods. There's been some Schwinger fermion and boson work. There's been assorted exact diagonalization work. And there's sort of more things going on. Ronnie's looking at some FRG. Other people are doing some more exact diagonalization. So there's a lot of interest in this model. What we'll do is, as I said, the variational study. But we'll use some of the insights from some of these things. When you're doing a variational study, you're writing down wave functions. And so these different studies have proposed mean field versions of wave functions or suggestions for what phases one might find. For example, at high J2, some of the exact diagonalization studies see different valence bond solids. So we'll leverage all that work to come up with good guesses, good ansatz for different wave functions that will allow us to look at these things. OK, so what's the primary game plan today? Well, there are going to be three steps. First, we're going to try to identify in the effective J1, J2 model where the spin liquid is. we already have a reasonable guess. If we just look at the Hubbard model correspondence, we'd expect to see something around 0.08 to 0.12. But let's forget about that for a minute. Let's forget about this correspondence with the Hubbard model and just take this model on its own merits and say, where is the spin liquid the variationally lowest ground state? And so to go about that, what we're going to do is we're going to write down good variational Lonsdots for the states around it. We know at small J2, this is the antiferromagnetic or Neel state. We know, presumably at large J2, this is going to be something like a valence bond solid. This seems to be consistently what's seen in all of these other methods as well. So we'll write down good wave functions for these three phases, and we'll look at who has the variationally lowest energy at the different points. Once we've bracketed the spin liquid, once we say, OK, this is where we want to really be looking at the spin liquid phase, then as a second step, we're going to try to identify what kind of spin liquid is it. Is it a gap spin liquid, a gapless spin liquid, a Z2 spin liquid? What exactly is it that we're looking at? And then finally, once we know what kind of spin liquid we're looking at, we'll go ahead and we'll examine some of its properties. We'll try to understand a little bit about it. So that's the game plan for today. So step one is going to be to write down wave functions for these different phases. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to tell you which wave functions we've written down. So for the antiferromagnetic state, for the Neel state, what we're going to do is we're going to write down a wave function in the following form. This wave function I'm about to describe, it goes by lots of names, Husserl states, correlated product states, string bond states, has a tendency to be sort of rediscovered over and over again. So here's the approach. You obviously can write out any wave function as an expansion in the SC basis. Then all you have to do to decide what it is you want these amplitudes to be. So we'll separately decide what we want the phase or the sign of these amplitudes to be in the real part. The phase, we'll have it obey the Marshall sign rule. I'll actually talk on the next slide a little bit about the Marshall sign rule because it'll become important a little bit later in the story. And for the real part, what we're going to do is the following. We're going to break this up into a product of pairs of latticites. And in principle, we could choose a different number for each of these pairs, but we're not going to do that. We are going to do something very general. We're going to say for each of the pairs, we're going to enforce translational invariance. We're going to allow the number that depends on this pair to just depend on the vector between them, Ri minus Rj. So this is the variational Lonsdots for the real part. And this means that this f is our variational parameters. So what we've done is we've written down a wave function, but this wave function encompasses a large class of things. And what we do is we optimize over these variational parameters. So for a 10 by 10 system, you know, let's say there are 100 vectors or 20 vectors or 200 vectors, something on that order. And this is the number of parameters that we're playing with here. OK, so we know how we pick the real part. We just do a lot of optimization. The phase or the sign, we use it to obey the Marshall sign rule. So what is the Marshall sign rule? Probably a lot of people are familiar with this, but I'm just going to go through it again because just to kind of give context. And some of these quantities will be relevant in a little bit. So the Marshall sign rule is just a prescription. It just says this is how you decide which configurations in your wave function are going to be assigned a positive sign and which configurations in your wave function are going to be assigned a negative sign. And this is specifically for a bipartite lattice. And the prescription is as following. Choose some configuration, let's say the stagger configuration, and assign it a positive sign. And then take all configurations that can be reached by flipping an up and a down spin. And assign that a negative sign, a nearest neighbor up and down spin. And then take this guy and look at all configurations that can be reached by flipping nearest neighbor up and down spin. Do this over and over again. This spans the entire space on a bipartite lattice. And this is just a prescription that tells you these configurations are positive. And these configurations are negative. It's unique. It specifies these things. OK, so why is this at all relevant? I mean, OK, any wave function is going to have some set of things that are positive and the other set that are negative. Why specifically this prescription? Well, what's relevant about this prescription is the following. If we have a Hamiltonian that's just a J1 Heisenberg model on a bipartite lattice, there's a proof, in fact, it's a two-line proof that I'll describe in a second, that any wave function that minimizes this ground state energy has the sign structure described here. And that's why this is sort of an important sign structure, a sign structure that we really should care about. OK, so this is my favorite two-line proof of that statement. So we can write the energy, obviously, as psi h psi, do a little bit of manipulations, and we see that it's this thing. So it's the sum over something squared times this guy. What is this guy? This guy essentially, for the J1 Heisenberg model, says sum over all nearest neighbor pairs. If the nearest neighbor pairs are the same, add a quarter. If they're different, subtract a quarter and then a half of this ratio. What is this ratio? This ratio is where you have nearest neighbor spins, their spin up and spin down, and you ask, what is the ratio of the wave function evaluated on this configuration with the configuration flipped? Okay? What is important about all of this is that the only place the sine of the wave function comes in here is there. This is squared. This is the only other place the wave function comes in at all. So the only place the sine of the wave function matters to the energy is in this term. Okay? If we could choose this term to be always negative, the sine of this term to be always negative, then this is the best we can do. Said another way, if someone gives me a wave function, and this is positive some of the time, I can give them back exactly the same wave function in terms of all the amplitudes, but change it so the sine is always negative, that wave function must have a lower energy. And consequently, that wave function must be the ground state. So this is really only for a J1 model. But what we should keep in mind is that our system is J1 plus J2, and these things are sort of linearly independent. So if we want to minimize the J1 energy, we should at least be paying some attention to what's going on with the Marshall sine rule. One can also say, if one turns on other terms, the ring exchange and these other things, the story is still the same. If J1 is larger than these other things, then at least we should be paying some attention to how much we're breaking J1 by violating the Marshall sine rule. Okay, so now I've described kind of explicitly this nail state. We know what the phases are, the sine is now. We know what the real part is. Now we've got to go ahead and describe what we're going to use for reasonable ansatz for the spin liquid. Okay, so in principle, what you ought to do is you ought to measure the energy of all possible spin liquids. For presentation's sake, it happens that I know that all of these spin liquids have almost the same energy, at least at this level of resolution. We'll look more closely at the different energies once we get to trying to identify the type of spin liquid, but at least trying to figure out where the spin liquid is, the energies are really all the same. So we're just going to pick one spin liquid, this algebraic spin liquid, and we're going to use that to compare against the energies of the nail state and the valence bond solids. So this algebraic spin liquid is defined in the following way. You just take a tight binding model of a nearest neighbor hopping on a honeycomb lattice. This gives you the following wave function. It's some determinant where the elements of the determinant are single particle orbitals, where the single particle orbitals are chosen from the tight binding model. And then you fill up the Fermi C, and you add correlations back by adding a projector. So this not only adds correlation back, but this takes what's a fermionic wave function and essentially turns it into a spin wave function. So this projects out double and zero occupancies. So this gives you a gapless spin liquid. This gives you a gapless state because this tight binding Hamiltonian was a semi-metal. And so this is one possible spin liquid. And this is the spin liquid we're going to go ahead and look at in terms of its energetics.
So it's known that if you make gap spin liquids and project a BCS, they have very similar energies. Is that the statement?
Well, it's known because we've looked at it. So in principle, I'm going to tell you about sort of the projected BCS story. And in principle, one could say, OK, we've looked at them all, and we've compared all the energies. But they're all very, very close. At the level of resolution that I'm about to show you, they're all on the same line. In fact, let me just show them to you. This here is the energy for the algebraic spin liquid. All of the other spin liquids that we've looked at, these projected BCS spin liquids, lie on this line. The error bar differences are so small that you couldn't see the difference on this graph. This is why, sort of for presentation's sake, we're really just going to pay attention to this one where we're trying to find out where the spin liquid is. So this is the energy of the algebraic spin liquid here as a function of J2 over J1. It's linear because really this is sort of a zero parameter wave function. And then the Hughes-Elser state, recall we reoptimized these parameters for each J2 over J1. So for each J2 over J1, you have to go and you've got to figure out the best set of this function. And this is the energies there. And so the crossing transition is about there, about 0.08 or 0.09. And it's reassuring that it's very close to this Hubbard transition, this correspondence that we had before. So that's sort of a nice feature. We weren't using the fact that we had this correspondence to the Hubbard model. But it turns out that it comes out very close. One can ask, how much should I trust the location of this transition? So I think a good metric is the following. I've done a little bit of poor man's DMRG, and I've compared against Sylvian's exact diagonalization result. And these energies are sort of good to the order of a percent. So you imagine these lines could come down, say, a percent or so. And that may push up this transition a little bit from 0.08 to 0.1 or something. So, I mean, one shouldn't, this is sort of coincidentally very close. One shouldn't believe that it really is exactly 0.08. But this is sort of the right spot for this spin liquid phase. OK, so we know that half of the story. We can go back and we can play the same game for the other end. So we've identified this transition. Let's now identify this transition. And to identify that transition, what we're going to be paying attention to is valence bond solids. The exact diagonalization seems to indicate that this is what's over here, valence bond solids. This is a reasonable guess for what's going on. So how are we going to write down a good wave function, a good variational ansatz for a valence bond solid? So what we're going to do is actually we're going to use a projected BCS form. So much like projected Gutzwiller, this is some BCS wave function. Here we're just going to be using real UKs and VKs. And we're going to go ahead and we're going to turn it into a spin wave function or add correlations by projecting out zero and double occupancies. Again, this can also be written as a determinant. But this determinant has some pairing function in it. It's a pairing function that eats the difference between the spin up location and the spin down location. OK, we're going to pay a little bit of attention to this pairing function because it can let us think about this projected BCS wave function in a different way. One way we can think about this wave function is that it's a compact way to represent an RVB state. What do we mean by an RVB state? Well, really, we mean you sum over all dimer coverings. You take the product over the singlets. And the relevant product here is this pairing function phi. Now, I'm hiding something about the sign here, but this is just sort of a heuristic way we should be thinking about this. Now, this is not a compact way to represent all RVB states. Obviously, the class of RVB states is very, very large. But it's a compact way to represent some RVB states. And what we should think about is that the RVB states we're representing are really being encoded, in some sense, by this pairing function. If this pairing function is large for small singlets, this tells us that we sort of preferentially prefer RVB states with small singlets. So this is kind of the heuristic understanding that we're going to use throughout the rest of this talk. And so we want to be paying attention to sort of this pairing function. Now, this projected BCS state actually encompasses more than valence bond solids. It encompasses many different phases. For example, you can write a spin liquid this way. You can write a valence bond solid this way. You can write lots of different things. And it's not always a trivial task to take these phis. This is going to be our optimization parameters. We're going to find the best pairing function that we can and back out exactly what the phase is. So we're going to use an operational definition for what a valence bond solid is. It's going to be something that breaks symmetry. So if the symmetry of this pairing function gets broken, we're going to say, there we have a valence bond solid. Whereas if it's not broken, then we're looking at something else. So for the moment, that's the operational definition that we'll be using. OK, so let's go ahead and continue kind of playing this game. We have a spin liquid energy, and we're going to get a valence bond solid energy. But before we even look at the energies, let's look at what happens. We're optimizing this projected BCS. Again, at every J2 over J1, you choose different pairing functions. You do some sophisticated optimization, and you find the best pairing function phis. And so we optimize actually a lot of parameters. But let's just pay attention to what happens if we optimize 9 parameters. So 3 vectors in the pairing function for the nearest neighbor, 3 vectors in the pairing function for the second nearest neighbors, and 3 vectors for the third nearest neighbors. And now as we tune J2 over J1, what happens? So up until J2 over J1 of 0.3, these vectors all have the same values in the pairing function, both for the nearest neighbor, second nearest neighbor, and third nearest neighbor. Somewhere between J2 over J1 of 0.3 and 0.4, there's a kind of very clear and significant breaking of that symmetry. All of a sudden, a vector pointing this way and a vector pointing this way want to have very different values of the pairing function. So this is a very clear signature that some sort of valence bond crystal is being formed. We have sort of a very clear, abrupt breaking of the symmetry.
In your case, the pairing wave function is always real.
The pairing wave function that I'm talking about here is always real. That's correct. We can consider a complex pairing wave function as well, and we will later. Now, one should appreciate that we know the true ground state has to be real, or one can choose the true ground state to be real because the Hamiltonian is real.
But like, if you start from this D plus ID, I think after projection, the true quantum wave function.
That's correct. That's exactly right. There's ways to choose pairing functions that are complex that give you real ground state wave functions back. We're not looking at that in our optimization, but a little bit later when we look at sort of more physically motivated states for the different spin liquids, I will talk about that. So in this, we're not looking at that, but in a little bit we will be.
I'm confused about the range you're doing. I thought you were going to concentrate on the 0.08 to 0.12.
So 0.08 to 0.12 we think is probably the correspondence to the Hubbard model. But right now we've broadened our horizons and we're looking at the whole range, well, at least 0 to say 0.5 or something. We're trying to figure out where the spin liquid is variationally best. So this is really just to bracket the spin liquid to find out where is it. And then we'll focus on our sort of main effort in identifying the type of spin liquid in the range that you're talking about.
The VPS pattern, is it columnar VPS?
Or? Yeah, so that's a great question. So I should say the following. I should say that when one looks at these, there's certainly amplitudes that are largest. And so the definitions are a little bit, columnar means different things depending on square and hexagon. So what it is the ones that pick out this one, this one, this one, so this column of things. So I call that columnar, but I've been told other people don't call that columnar, so I guess it depends on. But it's the ones that are parallel, essentially, to this thing. Now, I should say that with a little bit of a grain of salt, there's a lot of factor dressing of other singlets that are going on to keep this energy low. So really, when I say that, what I mean is that the amplitudes are strongest there, but lots of other singlets, lots of other things are going on.
Okay. Can I ask a question? Suppose I take your states now and I fix the nodes and I do basically a fixed node calculation. Mm-hmm. How these numbers renormalize?
Yeah, so that's a good question, and that's something that I'm thinking about doing, but it's not something that I've actually done. Okay, so beyond looking at the symmetries here, we can also look at the energies. And in the energies, we also see something very clear happening. We see that at J2 over J1 of 0.3, something very different begins happening. The projected BCS has been tracking the algebraic spin liquid all the way up to 0.3. And then after 0.3, it begins to kill over, and something very different happens. So for two good reasons, we have a reason to believe that around J2 of 0.3, something else is going on, that we're no longer in the spin liquid state. OK, so we've really sort of accomplished our first task of looking at where the spin liquid is in the J1, J2 model. Now we know where we want to focus our effort in trying to identify what type of spin liquid it is. Okay, so now we're going to go to our second task of trying to identify this type of spin liquid. But before that, I'm just going to have a sort of a one slide on optimization. So I've been saying we have a lot of functions. We have this pairing function phi. It's got, 20, 100 parameters. We have these Huse-Elster states. They have 100 parameters. We're doing a lot of optimization of these wave functions. And so I wanted to spend 2 minutes just saying something about optimization. So I'd say, in general, optimization of variational wave functions is still a little bit of a black art. One can do lots of naive things and not have it work at all. In the last half decade, there have been a lot of new approaches that really have been worked out. Some of the experts, like Sandra, are in the room here. Let me go ahead and tell you sort of why the naive things are bad, and at least one approach that we're using in this work. So one can write out the energy in this way. And this energy depends on a bunch of parameters. There's parameters in the wave function, these 100 parameters. Then one can write out the derivative of the energy with respect to each of these parameters in this way. But what we should appreciate is that this thing is true only in the limit of an infinite number of samples. If you don't have an infinite number of samples, this is a very noisy estimate. So one thing you say is, OK, close my eyes. Let me just take my favorite conjugate gradient routine. Let me use noisy samples, and let's just do conjugate gradient on it. This turns out to be a bit of a fiasco, because these black box optimization routines are well designed for objective functions that are not noisy and very poorly designed for objective functions that are noisy. Okay, you could say, fine, I'm just going to get rid of the noise. I'll just take a million samples. I won't have any stochasticity anymore, and I'll just solve my problem for a million samples. And this gets rid of the noise. It's true. Now you're optimizing some deterministic, complicated objective function. So these methods now work fine. except for you end up overfitting. You end up finding a really good energy for your million samples that's a really bad energy for the infinite system. So as I said, lots of naive approaches work poorly because the fact that we have this stochasticity in it, and you have overfitting problems, problems with large gradients that send you to nowhere, things are slow, et cetera. As I said, many new techniques have been devised by people like Sandro and Cyrus. I'm going to be using something that's advocated strongly by Sandvik. It's called stochastic optimization. It's reasonably robust, although a little bit slow. And the way it works is the following. For each parameter, compute some noisy estimate to the derivative. OK, we just said this was a disaster, so what's going on now? We have some horrible noisy estimate. But we're not going to be using almost anything about that estimate except for the direction of the parameter, the sign here. So we compute this noisy estimate, but throw out all the information about its direction, and just about its magnitude, and just move in the right direction for that parameter. And it's a little bit mysterious that this works, but it tends to work reasonably well and be reasonably robust. Again, it's sort of a simple idea, but lots of simple ideas break, and it happens to be that this simple idea doesn't. It's a small delta. It's just some constant that you choose. In fact, yeah, so 0.1, I mean, it depends a little bit on your parameters. If you think your parameters go over an order of magnitude, then it's bigger. In fact, what we do in practice is we choose some delta, get reasonably close, turn down delta, run it some more, so that you sort of slowly move to the top of your hill. OK, so this is just kind of, as I said, there's lots more to know about optimization. But this is just kind of the one slide approach to it. OK, so back to our main story. We've figured out where the spin liquid should be. Let's try to figure out what type of spin liquid it is. OK, so there are going to be two approaches that we'll take to trying to figure out what type of spin liquid it is. One approach is the following. We know that many spin liquids are encompassed by this projected BCS form. And we know how to write down the projected BCS form. So let's play the same game we've been playing all along. For each J2 or J1, optimize a whole series of parameters, see which guy wins. And in fact, this will be one of our approaches, and this is something that we'll do. But it has a couple problems. What are the problems? Well, first, we're going to get some pairing function phi. Then we're going to have to try to figure out, back out, what kind of spin liquid that was. This is a non-trivial task. It's not even clear, really, how to go about doing this in general. Secondly, we're doing optimization, and we're doing something that's reasonably good. But there's always danger that you're stuck in some local minima. You have 100 parameters or some huge parameter space. There's nothing that guarantees that you're avoiding local minima. And the other problem is that this is a large class of ansatz, but it misses certain states. So as you pointed out, because we're only optimizing real pairing functions, it's missing any states where you have complex pairing functions. Now, you could go ahead and optimize complex pairing functions. This makes things a little bit more difficult because lots of these give you complex wave functions that you want to try to avoid. So you could sort of play games with constraints and things, but that's not what we do. So this is one approach. The other approach is the following. The other approach is let's just choose physically motivated states. I mean, this is a very, very general approach. You write down sort of a huge class of ansatz. You say, just find the best thing. The other thing you say is, OK, let's think some more. Let's look in the literature for what people think these states look like. And let's choose things that are reasonable. And these things that are reasonable, they're going to have no parameters, or one or two parameters. Then we can just make a big grid, and we can choose the best thing. There's no danger of being stuck in a local optima. We know what these states physically are if we do this, because they're coming from some physical mean field or something. So this is kind of our second approach. So here we're going to be using a Schwinger fermion approach. This is mainly done by Ying Ran and company, although Fa Wang has done sort of an equivalent Schwinger boson technique. And how does this work? You take your spins, you fermionize them, and you add an additional constraint. And this constraint ensures that you're still looking at a spin model. And then they do two things. One is they use these projective symmetry groups to essentially guess what the right spin liquid state is. So what do I mean by that? Well, they list hundreds of spin liquid states, and they look at the ones that are continuously connected to the semi-metal, that have a gap, that essentially have the properties that are seen in the Hubbard model. And then they pick out a specific spin liquid state that's essentially generated from this mean field. So you have some mean field Hamiltonian. It has a nearest neighbor hopping. And it has a BCS pairing term. So this is between the A and B sublattice, the nearest neighbor hopping. This pairing term is between the AA and BB sublattices. But there's essentially, at the mean field level, a breaking of the sublattice symmetry. So you have a phase e to the I theta if you're between an AA sublattice, and e to the minus I theta if you're between a BB sublattice. So they suggest that this is a reasonable state to look at. They also go ahead and they do some mean field analysis and say, does it ever win at the mean field level? And what they find is the following. They find that if you set delta equal to 0, so that's the algebraic spin liquid. That just goes back to the hopping. We get rid of this term. That's the projected Gutzwiller that we looked at before. That wins in the mean field for small j2, the j2 that we actually care about. If you go to larger j2, then the winner is this S-wave thing, where delta is not 0, but theta equals 0. And then they argue, well, this SPS state, well, it never wins. But probably this S-wave is unstable to it. If you were doing something beyond mean field, that you would see it. So that's the story there. We can just take as inspiration this mean field Hamiltonian, and we can go ahead and we can optimize these parameters delta and theta, add a projection to it, and see if we see sort of who wins where. OK, so we're going to do that. We're just going to make a big grid and figure out which parameters win where. But let's actually go ahead and think sort of about the physics of what's going on and see if we can understand why some of these things may or may not be helpful. OK, so we're going to optimize this thing. We have a delta, we have a theta. But let's just think about it when we turn delta and theta off. This returns us to the projected Gutzwiller. But now we're thinking about it in the context of this projected BCS form, some limit of the projected BCS. So there's some pairing function. We know to think about our pairing function in terms of these singlets. So what does this tell us? It tells us that the singlet pairing function only connects the A and B sublattices. That's what this projected Gutzwiller does. That's what happens when you turn delta B 0. So this is nice for the following reason. This obeys the Marshall sine rule. We know it's good to obey the Marshall sine rule, at least when j2 equals 0. We know that's useful. On the other hand, when j2 gets large, having singlets that only connect A and B is no good at all. In fact, if j2 is very large, this really decomposes into the brown triangular sublattice and the white triangular sublattice. So you'd expect that really you primarily want singlets that connect the AA and BB sublattices. So as the frustration turns itself on, as j2 gets large, we really want to move from a state where we're connecting A and B to a state where we're connecting the other sublattices. And turning on delta does this. So we have delta equals 0. It's projected Gutzwiller. Let's sort of crank up delta a little bit. We begin getting terms that connect AA and BB. And so that's good. But this comes at a cost. We've broken the Marshall sine rule. We can ask, OK, maybe it's not so bad. How bad do we break the Marshall sine rule? And one metric, there are lots of ways you can look at this, but one metric is the following. We had already seen this earlier. This was the term that we knew we could always make negative and therefore gain as much energy as we could. And we can ask how often and how much of this term is positive instead of negative. How much could we win back if we decided, oh, let's turn the Marshall sine rule back on and forget about the AB singlets, the AA singlets. And this is essentially a graph of this as a function of Monte Carlo time. And what this is telling you is this is telling you you're always breaking the Marshall sine rule, and you're always breaking it a fair amount. OK, so this is going to make J1 unhappy. On the other hand, we're pacifying J2 some. So one can ask, there's some tension here. Who wins out? What really happens? And what we do is we find the following. We find that as we turn on delta for reasonably low frustration, J2 over J1 of 0.1, the place where we think the spin liquid is relevant, turning on delta just costs us a lot of energy, no matter what we do. Yes, the J2 is happier, but it's small, and the J1 is really very unhappy. So that's a bit unfortunate. But the following seems to happen when we turn on theta. We turn on theta. This is the sublattice breaking term. And we get much, much better energies. We restore all of the energy that we lost, and we beat out the projected Gutzwiller result. Somehow, turning on theta restores this energy and more. OK, we can ask ourselves, can we go back and understand why that was? And what we can do is we can think again about the Marshall sine rule. We know turning on delta caused a lot of trouble. But if we use a non-trivial data, we essentially restore the Marshall sine rule. We don't restore it exactly, but we approximately restore the Marshall sine rule. So notice the difference in scales here. This goes from 0 to 1.4. This goes from 0 to 0.1. there's a huge gain in energy that we restore from restoring the Marshall sine rule. In fact, on this plot, both things are plotted, and as you can't even see the one. I mean, it really almost entirely restored the Marshall sine rule. So this is sort of the best of all worlds. You're pacifying J1 because you're not losing out on sort of this negative energy that you can get. But you have these AA singlets and BB singlets that make J2 happier. So we can really think of this as the reason why having a delta and theta turned on might help us. In fact, we can see, in fact, that it does help us, even for low frustration. So why is this story important? Well, it's also important because if you turned on, say, J3 or ring exchange, all of this is going to hold. You've essentially still keeping track of the Marshall sine rule. You're still making J1 very happy. And so even a small ring exchange, I think, is not going to change things significantly. OK, so now we can do what we said we were going to do. We can go ahead and we can make a big grid. We can find the best parameters. OK, we do this, and there's some set of parameters. Theta is something, and delta is something. So this was one of our approaches. We said the other approach is we were just going to do a bunch of optimization with our projected BCS form.
Can I just ask this one?
Yeah.
What precisely is your variational wave function now for this
right now? So I can say the following. It's the wave function. You solve this for the mean field, and you project it. You project out all double occupancy. And that's the wave function. It is of the form of the projected BCS that we wrote down earlier. It has some pairing function, but these pairing functions are complex.
And you optimize these delta AJs numerically before?
We just essentially make a grid of delta and theta, so we find the best delta and theta.
But in your case, this is still uniform, right? This delta e twice theta everywhere is uniform. It's not like a d plus I.
Yeah, it's not. This isn't a general thing. It's true. This is, yes, a uniform delta.
Yes, could you consider this non-uniform delta?
Yes, certainly one can. I mean, there are always ways to sort of expand the class of variation yet. At some point, you have to make a decision about what things you're looking at. But if there is some reason to believe that that's sort of a useful thing to do, one could certainly do it.
You're going to break all kind of symmetries in this way.
You are going to break certain symmetries in this way, but the whole deal with projection is that it restores many of these symmetries. In fact, the fact that this is coming out of this projective symmetry group analysis is essentially telling you that you restored all of the symmetries of your essentially the unicell, so the translation and the rotation on the honeycomb lattice and such. So the mean field, the symmetries are broken, it's true.
Do you still break time reversal?
No, time reversal is not broken. After projection. And obviously at the mean field it is. Okay, so we found the state. It looks like it's the winning state. One could say, okay, now aren't we done? Haven't we kind of found our state? There's one more detail that we should worry about. Okay, as I said, we've done, maybe I didn't finish saying this, we did this optimization over all these projected states. None of them win. We have 100 parameters. None of them seem to beat SPS. And one way to think of that is we're not looking at complex things. And because we're not looking at complex things, and we sort of saw that the complex amplitudes were very important, it's not surprising that this large class of other ansatz seems not to be winning. OK, so one more detail. This is the amount of energy that we've gained, this red line. And this is for a specific system, a 14-by-14 system. And one should worry that maybe this doesn't survive in the thermodynamic limit. In fact, one should worry a lot because this is that same red arrow. This is the energy gain by opening up a gap. And this is the different energies for different size systems for the projected Gutzwiller. So they're on the same magnitude as the finite size effects are sort of on the same magnitude as opening up a gap. So why is this? This almost never happens. This is essentially because the energy gained by opening up a gap is very small. We have Dirac cones. So essentially, we're opening up a gap where the density of states is zero. If you open up a gap where the density of states is zero, you just don't gain very much energy. So one has to be a little bit careful about going to the thermodynamic limit. So one can plot as a function of 1 over L the energy differences between the SPS state and the projected Gutzwiller state, the gapless state. And there's no indication that it's going to zero. There's some annoying non-monotonicity here. But we understand what's causing that. This is largely because of incommensurability effects with the box that we're using. OK, so every indication is even in the thermodynamic limit, this SPS state beats out the projected Gutzwiller. So it really is some sort of gapless state. So this has been looked at very carefully at J2 over J1 is 0.1. One can ask, what other J2s over J1s does SPS wean? So one can look at the energy as a function of J2 over J1, and it weans all the way out to at least 0.2. Now, what we've really done here is we've really fixed the parameters, the ones that were good for 0.1, and looked for a whole range of J2 over J1. So if it weans, this means the best SPS weans, right? The best parameters are better than the parameters we're looking at. It starts losing around 0.2. What that means is that means we don't know whether or not these parameters are good or not. It could be that SPS really loses, or it could be that these parameters are just not very good. All right. So now we're going to go ahead and we're going to examine the properties of this spin liquid state. So we've identified what type of state it is. We've identified where it is. Now we just want to figure out what are its different properties. So how are we going to do this? Well, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to look at this pairing function. So maybe this sort of explicitly answers your question, what does this wave function look like? It's of the projected BCS form. It has some pairing function. And we can actually just explicitly look at that. And so as a function of distance, what we see is we see that things decay. Small singlets are preferred. Long singlets exist but are not as preferred. And we have this sort of sublattice symmetry breaking. And it's broken in sort of this mean field thing. We can ask, does it stay broken in the same way, the kind of natural way, when you look at the pairing function? And it does. Things that connect the singlets that connect the AA sublattice have some set of phases. And the singlets that connect the BB lattice, so this is 0, have the exact same phases but opposite signs. Yes?
Have you tried to fit the decay of the pairing amplitude to some power law or convention?
Not very carefully. It looks exponential like, but I mean it's I wouldn't put any faith in that. It's gapped though. I mean, we know this is a gap spin liquid from the kind of Schwinger fermion. But in terms of asking, can you see it in the data very clearly, the answer is at these sort of system sizes, no. Okay, so can we understand how this affects the amplitude of different configurations? These are the pairing functions, and this obviously affects the configurations in some way. So let's go back to our three states. The algebraic spin liquids, it has no large weight between AA singlets. So really it prefers states that just connect the A and the B sublattice. When you turn on delta, you have this S wave, it has something that looks just like this, except for all these phases are 0. All this means are short singlets are preferred and long singlets are not. So OK, it likes to have large weight on configurations with short singlets. But this sublattice state does something a little bit weird. By adding in this data, what it essentially does is it says it wants large weights where you have the same number of short AA singlets and short BB singlets. OK, can we see that in this way? So imagine we have some dimer pattern. But let's just pay attention to these three short singlets. I mean, there are lots of dimers I haven't driven, but imagine there's a whole dimer pattern here. There are three short BB singlets and three short AA singlets. And one works out the weight, and you have 3 times some positive phase and 3 times some negative phase, and those phases cancel and it's 0. The phase data doesn't matter at all. But now, imagine you have 6 short BB singlets and no short AA singlets. This S wave state wouldn't care at all. It just counts the number of short singlets. But this phase, you attenuate significantly by sort of e to the minus 6i data, the weight of this configuration. So somehow this state, in some sense, knows about the sublattices and says, we really want some sort of symmetry on these sublattices. We want the same number of short AA and short BB singlets.
Something. Are the configurations fully packed with dimers?
Yeah, so this is a, I'm just paying attention to some of them, but mentally fully packed the rest of them with.
You mean that if you have some AA singlets, you will have an equal number of BB singlets?
That's correct. So the way you want to think about this is in this picture where I have 6 AA singlets, think of the other BB singlets as long, that they're essentially unimportant in this picture. But yeah, so we're focusing on sort of the short singlets here because those are the ones with the large amplitude. So essentially, we've traded off some long AB singlets for some long BB singlets, but it's not going to make any difference. So this is sort of one intuitive way that one can understand what this this state is doing. So I should say that a sublattice breaking state, a state that in some sense, at least in the mean field, breaks the sublattice symmetry, has some appeal because we have these Dirac cones. These Dirac cones are well protected. One of the ways that you can destroy the gap in these Dirac cones is by breaking the sublattice symmetry. OK, so what other things can we look at for our state? Well, one of the things we can do is we can try to estimate the gap. So we have a variational ground state wave function. I mean, we can't pull out the gap explicitly from this. But we can do a sort of a naive thing. We know that this variational wave function came from some mean field. It's essentially a BCS mean field. And we've gone ahead and we've optimized these parameters. We have a best delta and a best theta for this mean field. And so we can read off the BCS gap. So for the n equals 14 case, the BCS gap that we read off for the best parameters is t over 14. And the Hubbard model gets t over 14. OK, this is just coincidentally kind of ridiculously close. But they match up reasonably well. If we go to some other system size, n equals 10, we can play the same game. There's some other set of parameters that are optimum. We can read off again what the gap is. It's t over 5.5. And the Hubbard model, the DQMC simulations, give t over 10. So this is reassuring. These gaps are sort of the right order of magnitude. This is a very naive estimate. We're pretending the mean field gap is correct. There's no reason to believe they should be very good. But the fact that they're in the right order of magnitude is a reassuring thing. It gives us sort of more evidence that the state that we're looking at is the reasonable one. OK, something else we can do is we can look at the dimer-dimer correlations. Now, one shouldn't carefully compare the magnitudes of these correlations. Even if one were to take, so this is from the Assad paper, even if one were to carefully take, say, the hexagon, which they've done in the Hubbard model, and exactly diagonalize it, and do the same thing with the Heisenberg hexagon, the amplitudes are going to be very, very different. And that's because these are Hubbard spins, they're charge fluctuations, et cetera, and these are Heisenberg spins. On the other hand, although one shouldn't take the amplitude seriously, one can reasonably seriously take the signs, telling us if things are correlated or anti-correlated. And this is their picture out to some distance. And this is our picture out to the same distance. And what you'll see is you'll see every sign, this is the reference slice, every sign matches up exactly. There are these blue hexagons. There are the red spice coming out of them. Even the signs nearby, everything matches up out exactly to the distance that we care about. Now, one should be a bit careful. The algebraic spin liquid also looks similar. So I wouldn't consider this evidence for this very specific Z2 spin liquid. I would consider this strong evidence that this really is sort of the dimer pattern that one expects from spin liquids, and consequently that likely they're seeing some sort of spin liquid. In fact, one can look at,
How does the decay of as a function of distance behave in your case?
It decays quickly. It looks exponential, but I haven't, I mean, this data isn't super good, and so quickly.
Is the pattern linked to the sublattice symmetry breaking?
No, so the algebraic spin liquid doesn't have any of the sublattice symmetry breaking, but it has a very similar pattern. So I really wouldn't take it as evidence for the sublattice symmetry breaking. I would just take it evidence that it's one of these sort of Z2 RVB-like spin liquids. So that's a good question. I haven't looked very carefully at that. Presumably because these Kalmar crystals are breaking symmetry, and then you're saying, okay,
superpose
them.
It actually can look quite different from the mean.
That's true. So I haven't looked carefully at that. One could do that. I don't know. What I have looked somewhat more carefully at is, say, the Hughes-Elser state, just to make sure all dimer configuration patterns don't more or less look like that if you do something reasonable. So I took a Hughes-Elser state that was close to J2 over J1 of 0.8, right where the energies are the same. So this is a good Hughes-Elser state in the following sense. It has very close energies to the right configuration, to the best configuration. And that looks significantly different. For example, it's red here and it's blue there. So it's not that all dimer patterns more or less look like this. There are states that have significantly different dimer patterns. OK, so one can play games. One can look at the correlations and things. One cannot play all sorts of things. So I think now I will conclude. So we've looked at this spin liquid state. We've bracketed where it is. We've found the nail state and the Hubbard model. The nail state and the valence bond solid to both sides. And we think that the Z2 spin liquid, this SPS state, is a strong candidate for a spin liquid phase they see in the Hubbard model. It's variational lowest energy, the transition location's about right, the naive estimate of the gap is about right, the sign of the dimer-dimer correlations are about right. There's sort of lots of things going in favor of this. We can understand why it wins. It wins because it essentially approximately satisfies the Marshall sign rule, while still allowing singlets that are important for the J2 energy. So in the future, we really should sort of look at this in sort of projection or fixed node, and someone asked about that. One could also look more carefully at ring exchange. One could get ambitious and try to see if one could do similar things at the level of the Hubbard model, as opposed to worrying about whether we've captured, sort of in perturbation theory, the effective spin model.
I
think the statement that it's robust is not necessarily true. I think the statement is that the primary energy here is the J1 energy. And we know that this SPS state has the advantage of essentially restoring the sign rule and consequently pacifying the J1. So it is my suspicion, but I have no good evidence of this, that even small other terms like ring exchange are going to see similar stories. But I think robust is a much too strong word.
So do you see the spin gap coming down as you approach the nail state, or does it look like a transition? But look at your variational delta that you get, the sign of it going to zero as you, or at least decreasing as you approach the nail state.
Let's see. No, I don't think there's any strong evidence that it's decreasing, but I haven't looked very carefully at that, and so one could look at the data more carefully and actually figure out if that's really what's going on or not.
These exact numerics, it looks like a continuous transition. Mm-hmm. Right? So
right, yeah, so I don't think there's any strong evidence of that at the variational level. Of course, it could be that as you kind of get very close to the transition point, that these variational wave functions are in some sense too simple to really capture the physics of what's going on. They're good inside the phases, but around the transition, maybe more complicated things are going on.
You might still see a trend.
You still might see a trend, I agree. One should look carefully at that.
I have a similar question. I've seen there is strong finite size effect in the energy gain, but in the variational parameters, you should have much more control. Do you have some plot on how this delta in theta depends on the system size?
So I know, for example, here you can see that at n equals 10, so this is L equals 10, 10 by 10. I can do many things. So I don't. I have a couple points, and I know that sort of this gap goes down. These parameters move in such a way that the gap goes down as the system gets larger. But I don't have sort of a complete plot of many sizes and some sort of extrapolation of these things.
You have done the calculation. You should have the data somewhere.
For some system sizes, I do. And for other system sizes, we were just using the same delta and data because our thermodynamic...
Don't optimize.
For some, we do. But for others, no, we don't independently optimize. We just ask, does this delta or theta beat out it at the thermodynamic limit? So it might be that actually the energy gain is better than what we see. But if this delta and theta win, we know that some delta and theta wins, and therefore we're happy. So even doing a grid of points is sort of still a non-trivial calculation, but.
Other questions?
So is it true that if I look at the ordered side, there is some proposal for some kind of pneumatic kind of, it's not just pure Navy, there's some pneumatic ordered kind of also.
There are some proposals for that.
Just after the.
Right into the nail phase, that's right.
So can you compare energy? Can you write a variational state with that order parameter?
One could try to write such a state. Likely, it would look something like this Hughes-Elser, except for the Hughes-Elser, we are sort of enforcing some constraints that one would probably turn off in order to get a state that looks like that. So I haven't done it, but presumably one could. Yes, I mean, presumably that's the argument that in fact this intermediate state helps you in terms of the continuity of the
but your data is never zero, your data is always almost
The delta that we see, as I say, we haven't done sort of a careful study as a function of this, but the deltas we see are always reasonably large. Kind of a new. Right, obviously as J2 gets large, and you saw that plot where the energies came down, then delta goes to zero.
In your calculation, you compare the energy of this antiferromagnetic kind of spin liquid. So what kind of directional state do you use to calculate that, to describe this antiferromagnetic order in the system?
So it's this Hughes-Elster state. It's the state where you choose the amplitudes, the phase by the Marshall sign rule, and these amplitudes by this sort of product of spins.
But if with J1, J2, in principle, there's a sign problem. So
sure. In fact, right. As you turn up J2, presumably it doesn't satisfy it exactly. But the evidence has canonically been from calculations that other people have done that while you're in the nail state, the sign rule stays reasonably well satisfied. I mean, there's no proof that that happens to be true here.
So in principle, there can be even lower energy to describe this order case. So in your case, it's kind of still a little bit biased for this.
Sure. Yeah, there's no question that all of these wave functions are going to have some systematic bias. And as you tune add in more and more parameters, you're going to be able to pull the energy lower and lower down. I mean, this is sort of the nature of variational Monte Carlo. The best you can do is pick reasonably good variational states with some reasonable set of parameters. And as I said, you shouldn't believe sort of the numbers were things. You shouldn't believe it hits a 0.08 exactly. But you should, in essence, believe some of the qualitative things that come out.
So you have a nail phase and the gas and the spin liquid in between.
Yes.
There are systems where there is a direct transition between nail and VPS, right? The favorite story of decoupling gradient,
sure.
For example. And what's seen that these direct transitions involve huge fluctuations. Even if they are weak person-based transition, they still involve huge fluctuation, meaning that the wave function should be really non-trivial. And if, for example, you would try to optimize the energy with some simplistic wave function, I would say that instead of direct phase transition, you would see spin liquid intervening, just because spin liquid wave function is probably the best way to describe this non-trivial fluctuating VBS or nail phase. So my question is, what would be your argument to exclude these direct scenarios?
Okay. So I guess, I mean, right, these are variational wave functions. You can't rule out that the real wave function is very complicated and somehow you're missing it. I think one thing one can say is that the range where we see the spin liquid is really sort of a non-trivial extent. And so it would be a little bit surprising if it turns out that the whole state should go to zero. But of course, one can't strictly rule it out.
The size
of the range is going from sort of this 0.08 to 0.3. This is sort of a big chunk.
Is there a sign rule for J2?
No, because essentially it's these triangular lattices. In large J2, you essentially have triangles, and so then there's no sign rule.
Are there further questions?
So you looked at the gap in the sensor to be say sparing amplitude of the function, wave function that you're putting in.
Mm-hmm.
Can you do a very different quasi-particle state like Uta gamma dagger times BBS and project and then look at the difference of energy and get an estimate of gap?
Yeah, one can play more sophisticated games. One can try to take one's variational wave function and promote some triplet somehow. One could, in principle, vary an entire variational wave function with the constraint that it's orthogonal to the ground state. There are certainly more sophisticated one things can do. This is sort of a naive estimate. One has to sort of, right, it's variational wave functions. As one pushes harder and harder in playing these games, one has to sort of trust the quality of one's wave functions more and more. And so one should be careful sort of how much one asks from this level of analysis.
Other questions? that's not the case, let us think.